Hello, and we are back with another installment of the Communique on Lunk Radio, lunkradio.org, coming soon to 1580 AM on the AM radio dial. Today is April 18th, 2009. I am your host, Jackson Meredith, and I am joined in a very full room today by
Andrew,
Wissam,
Charles,
and Vladimir.
And I've brought this scurvy bunch of radical dudes together to talk about May Day. Now, I mean, in this country, May 1st is generally associated with kind of a goofy little spring holiday and some strange traditions. But for most of the world, and indeed for this country not so terribly long ago, May Day is the real International Labor Day. And there are huge May Day demonstrations all over the world to this day. But this is a holiday that's been basically lost in this country. We've had an official American Labor Day, which comes on a Monday in September, and that's been lost since about 1880. I don't have the date in front of me, but it's about 120 years ago now. Then the other May 1st significance, under President Eisenhower, President Eisenhower signed May 1st to be Law Day, which is an interesting little bit of propaganda considering that came at one of the high points of the Cold War, and obviously the Soviet Union and its occupied countries all made a big deal out of May Day. Speaking of the Soviet bloc, I have Vladimir over here, who is sort of our European representative, and feel free to chime in. I mean, what have been your experiences with May Day?
Oh, I don't know about Soviet Union. I've been to Soviet Union twice for 2 months altogether right before the Union dissolved. So I'm not competent to talk about what about significance of May Day in Soviet Union. I don't doubt it was a official holiday, the same way it used to be in former Yugoslavia, a country I came from. But in former Yugoslavia, May Day was more than just official federal holiday. It was endorsed and cherished by laborers in former Yugoslavia. It was the most important holiday in those times, since Yugoslavia was a socialist country. In opinion of Erich Fromm, in those times, in mid-70s, there were only two democratic countries in the world, and he named Sweden and former Yugoslavia. I'm saying this just as a caveat that, May Day was not only officially prescribed as a federal holiday, it was, as I said, accepted by working class in former Yugoslavia, and it did have its official part of the program. There would be parades all the way ever since the World War II until maybe early 70s, when that habit was abandoned, discontinued. There were no parades anymore. Pressure of Cold War tensions between Eastern and Western blocs relaxed in Yugoslavia, since Yugoslavia actually emancipated itself from the influence of Stalin's Soviet Union right after World War II. So we did have a relaxed attitude when it came to celebrating May Day. We would have short speeches recalling the history of the holiday, honoring people who gave their lives and sacrificed in multiple other ways for the benefits of new generations, me being one of them. And I really did have that feeling in those times of belonging to something much bigger than it was just a celebration of May Day in Yugoslavia. I did have that feeling of identity with emancipation of working class globally. And the sad part of it is my deflation of that feeling of belonging to something bigger. When I first came to the United States 11 years ago, I realized how manipulated May Day in this country was, and realized that the feeling I was talking about was actually an illusion of mine. And it was sad when I realized that, for two reasons. The first one is I lost that feeling of belonging to something big. The second reason was betrayal, actual betrayal by working class, betrayal of the tradition of fight of working class in this country for better life, for emancipation from exploitation, etc., etc. Well, I don't like to use big words, you know, even the word exploitation, no matter how well alive it still is, and even more than it used to be globally, I still don't like to use those words because they sometimes sound counterproductive.
Well, you alluded to sort of the long and bloody history of the holiday a little while ago, and I suppose it's probably a good time to bring up some of this history of the holiday, and especially it's sort of the lost American roots of this holiday. May Day was first celebrated as an International Labor Day in the year 1886 at the height of international labor fights. At that time, the key demand was the 8-hour workday. And we sort of take the 8-hour workday for granted today, but there was a time in the 19th century where it was very common for workers to work 10, 12, 14-hour days, at least 6 days a week. And so the first May Day in 1886, protested all over the world, was primarily about the slogan and demand for an 8-hour workday. One of the major sites in the United States for May Day protests was in the city of Chicago. A series of protests over several days in early May 1886 were just increasingly violent, with the police killing protesters. I mean, obviously, the labor history of this country is very, very bloody, and that is typically left out of the textbooks. On May 4th, 1886, there was a massive workers' protest against two workers who were killed by the police in an earlier protest a few days prior. Late in the day, a phalanx of police came up to break up the protest, and a bomb was thrown into the police, increasing violence. A total of 7 police and protesters, I believe, were killed. The deaths of the police in that particular instance were used as a pretext in Chicago to lock up the anarchist labor leaders of the city. They were all charged for the murder of the police officer, although only one of the 7 men was even present at that particular protest, and he was giving a speech from the podium when the bomb was thrown. A year later, they were tried and convicted and sentenced to death. 4 of them, Albert Parsons, August Spies, George Engel, and Adolf Fischer, were executed. A 5th man, Louis Ling, commits suicide in prison to avoid his execution. The final 3, Michael Schwab, Samuel Fielden, and Oscar Nieb, were pardoned many years later in 1893. These 7 men are collectively known today as the Haymarket Martyrs because of the events in Haymarket Square, Haymarket Park in Chicago. This was huge stuff back when it happened. Emma Goldman credited the kangaroo court that tried the Haymarket Martyrs as the event that politicized her, that radicalized her politics. There was massive international outcry, which had basically no effect. Obviously, these damn anarchists had to be put to death, and that's basically what happened. This bloodshed on the first May Day in 1886 really galvanized the labor movement and really made later anniversaries of the holiday very important and sort of built it into the major holiday that it is today. I want to turn to Wassam here. I mean, we sort of heard from Vladimir on sort of the European perspective. You're sort of here representing Iraq and the Middle East. I mean, how big is May Day in the Middle East?
It's pretty much huge in Iraq. That's what I'm familiar with, because as I recall, when Abdul Karim Qasim took power of the government in a coup, he was our first socialist president, and he introduced the holiday as May Day, you know. And what happens is when another coup took place and the Ba'athist Party took power, they executed him and they abolished May Day, basically, or they took a detour for their own benefits. So after Saddam, like the information I got from 2007, the Iraqi Socialist and Communist Party started, they resurrected. I mean, they've been in power the whole time, but May Day resurrected, like with much of the information I gathered in 2007. That's when they started, you know, issuing May Day, and it became a holiday again. And it have a lot of people, like a huge amount of people in it. Like, I would say about 500,000 in Iraq, in the southwest, basically, between Nasiriyah, Basra, Sumawa. So it's pretty huge. And, I mean, I'm here, like, trying to put out the word, because they never had a chance to come out and say what they want to say, you know, beside the internet. So today, it's a good thing that I'm here to represent their side of it, and I brought a lot of their notes to bring them out and say what they really want, instead of trying to just hear it out from someone else. So I'm glad that I'm here.
And what have the May Day protests in Iraq recently, what have they been demanding? What have they been calling for?
Well, they've been calling for end to the occupation, end to the sectarian violence and fighting, their society to, you know, that have their civil rights and society to put back in place. And I mean, I have a whole list of things, and to the oppression, and to huge companies that come there and lobby on their oil to sell it, you know, for Exxon or BP. So that is their main goal, and to have equal rights and fair wages for their workers and a lot of things. I mean, I can read you a couple of things if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Well, I would like to say, start with the workers in Iraq received May Day this year, living amid the dark scenario of the war, occupation, and sectarian fighting, which has destroyed the pillar of civil society, pushed decades back, and destroyed any possibility for the masses to live in a secure and a normal life. So, on May Day this year, the workers of Iraq are passing through the harshest historical period ever. Not only that, Iraqi worker wages, working hours, social security, basic rights, and gain went through a long year of hard struggle and under attacks by their physical extinction and was in danger. The occupation, sectarian war, and pillaging the country wealth have turned the lives of workers in Iraq to a real hell. The worker class in Iraq engaged in a great struggle against the occupation. I would like to say it's puppet government and gangs and militias of all section of political Islam. They and their progressive organization are striving to end the occupation, curb these brutal militias, and rebuild the civil society. And that is one of the things they're asking for, and there's a couple other things I can mention later on.
Now, what is this you're reading again? Is this a May Day declaration from
the Iraqi Communist Party?
The Iraqi Communist Party.
Which it just resurrected, but the new Iraqi government won't give them any seat in the parliament. They kicked them out because they have no religious ties. So they were kicked out. So I would like to say that one thing.
As I understood it, the government, when they took their occupation in there, made it a prerequisite for any sort of ruling bodies that they wouldn't be a leftist or worker-based organizations. Have you heard of that, Jackson?
A little bit.
No, I totally agree with you that it was true. Basically, what happened is they molded their own government in Iraq. They got a baby, they nurtured him, and they put him in the new Iraqi government. And that's what happened. Like, most socialists or communists in Iraq are actually mostly the doctors, the teachers, the lawyers, the professors you go to, your pharmacists, your engineers. So they held that, you know, because they didn't want to lie. They didn't want to take the religious route and be fanatics. They pretty much took the educational route. And even during Saddam, I would like to say, they were also getting executed to the highest ends, because in Iraq during Saddam, he was a Baptist, which he would buy weapons from Soviet Union, but he did not want to be any communist in Iraq. So he was like a radical Baptist. And right now it's like they were fighting him for the longest time, but now they have more open airspace to say what they want to say and to get their point across.
Is it just a regional phenomenon, or do you see any signs of the same organizations and attitude in the rest of Iraq?
Well,
in Kurdish population, for instance?
The Kurdish population have their own, I believe it's the KB, Kurdish Workers' Party. They have their own, and they fight the Turks all the time. So if you ever hear about the Turks attacking the Kurds, that's the Iraqi communists, the Kurdish communists, and the Iraqi Kurds, the Arab communists, and the Kurds, they have alliance. And also there is communist parties in Syria. It's big. Jordan, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, but it's under the radar. So it's like growing in the Middle East, because they just want, basically, you know, to be treated as human beings, or to have, you know, fair wages and to have equal education. So I think it's going to keep growing, and I don't see an end to it, because they fought Saddam for 30 years, so I believe nothing can take them down at this point.
Do the Kurds have May Day demonstrations as well?
Oh yeah, they do, but I'm not familiar with that, because I lived in Iraq in the south. But yes, they have it, and I believe they would celebrate it more openly than the Arab population, because they're more of a democratic territory in their territory right now.
And more secular.
Yeah, so they're more safer, and I'm glad to say they do celebrate it freely, and I would love to go there and see it.
Well, I mean, I sort of started talking about the history here, and we're still talking about still having huge May Day protests all over Europe, especially, I mean, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, in Iraq, as Wassam is saying, really all over the world. And yet, I mean, the United States, basically the country where May Day was born and where it really became a permanent holiday, it's basically a lost phenomenon. And I'd like to go a little more into some of the history behind that. I believe it was under President Grover Cleveland who made Labor Day into the September holiday in this country. And then there was sort of a concerted effort with the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, which was the largest and a more business-friendly union under the leadership of Samuel Gompers, that basically said, yep, we'll have Labor Day in September, and it'll be a big patriotic affair. It's not an internationalist affair. It's a nationalist affair, a patriotic affair. And essentially, the moderate and the mainstream sort of labor activists went along with Gompers and the AFL, and the fighters, the radicals, and the labor organizers that stuck with the original May Day were marginalized as radicals, and the holiday was really lost in this country by about the turn of the 20th century.
What year was that? Was Gompers still president when the AFL made that decision?
Yes, he was.
Because
I believe he was.
It's interesting because the AFL is actually one of the organizations that first called for the commemoration of the Haymarket Massacre. I think in 1888, they weren't called the AFL. At that time, they were called the U.S. Federation of Organized Trade and Labor. But they sent delegates to the European meeting of what would later be called the Second International, and actually convinced the European delegates to spread the May Day event throughout Europe. It was essentially an American event until that time, until 1890. They did 2 years of planning, however, and it became an internationalist movement. I was under the impression that it became, that the more radical aspects became more alienated from the event after the Bolshevik Revolution, but I suppose it could have started before then, too.
Is my understanding the May 1st Labor Day was really lost in this country by about 1900. It really didn't survive very long. And it had to do with marshaling good, patriotic, moderate labor organizers and union members and, you know, wannabe union members, since belonging to a union was very much a criminal act at this time, and marshaling them all to the state-sanctioned holiday in September, and leaving a handful of anarchists on May 1st to get clubbed by the police.
Mm-hmm. Anarchists and communists.
The
Communist Party, especially in the 30s, was starting in the 20s when they split from the Socialist Party. They were still very much promoting and organizing May Day events. And it was there was a dispute, I know, between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, because obviously in the Soviet Union, May Day was carried on as a great working men's tradition. Mm-hmm. But because the SP was critical of the Bolshevik regime, that also kind of divided the working class movement here in the United States. So
the Russians have their own May Day martyrs. I believe during the aborted revolution of 1905, on May Day, a large number of peasants were shot to death when they attempted to deliver a petition to the Tsar's palace. And that was May Day 1905, if memory serves. And certainly that would be very important to the Russian end of May Day.
I would like to add, I also have the rest of the article from Iraq, if you don't mind me. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like why I think May Day is very important in Iraq, and so it says, the second part of it is the working class is going through the most repressive economic, political, and social situation due to deep capitalist economic crisis, which we're all familiar with, capitalism. 10 million of workers were sacked during the past year, and that is of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And the tax is being organized by various capitalist regimes in the West and the East on workers achieving their political and civil rights and their wages. The percentage of poverty has gone up and widespread as the number of these living under poverty line reach 500,000 people, while the wealth of human society is building up from labor on workers, whereas hungry, poverty, and deprived among the inched upward. The horrific increase of phenomena such as taking drugs, and this is like happening in Iraq due to the capitalist problem, like selling buddies, which have to do with prostitution, and committing suicide has been a high rate in Iraq, like suicide. Organized crime, we're all familiar with it, in Iraq you always trading in human beings, which mostly about kidnapping or selling people for body parts. And all other social unions condemn this oppressive capitalist world. The international bourgeoisie agreed to get over the world economic crisis, agreed on unholy defense of private ownership and its own worn-out regime. They are united against our movement, which is this is what the Iraqi, Socialist Party and Communists asking for. And the working class, despite their deep political differences and despite raising false slogans and ethical, national, and religious identity, they raise the slogan to mislead and contain working class movement and oppressed masses. They agreed on preventing the protest and demonstration on the working class. So, where else in Iraq the workers are not only threatened with work condition in terms of working hours, how wages lack. Low wages, lack of social security, blunted their wealth and the destiny of society, but also with their lives and their extinction. Going to work has become full of danger to a tremendous extent. And I would like to add that in Iraq, workers don't have worker rights as we speak right now. There is no, you lose a finger, you go home. You lose an arm, you go home. You break your foot, you're fired. You're fired and somebody else would take. So the workers are gathering areas have become a direct target for suicide attacks and booby traps. The workers of Iraq are the prime victims of war, occupation, sectarian conflict, and aggression and provocation of ethnic conflict on old, false, rotten slogans of so-called centralization and decentralization.
Well, it sounds like the Iraqis need a labor movement.
They need a, well, that is what I'm like trying to spread out the word, and Iraqis are fighting for it, like, really, you know, and that is why May Day, it's so huge in Iraq, it can't be stopped right now, because they're fighting for workers, right? And they're like, the Iraqi people are like, oh, welcoming it with open arms, because there is no religious ties, so they're more happy to join it. And I'm hoping, like, an actual May Day, I would like to see on the news in Iraq, it's going to be a huge turnout.
Would you say that helps, that it has no religious ties, the different religious divides can be... people of different groups, it can be appealed to, because it doesn't have that sort of divisive nature to it?
Well, I think it's a great thing, because nobody can come there and argue about religious beliefs, whose
right.
God is better, or my belief, or your book, or my book. They're all fighting for the same causes, bringing them together as human beings. Like, hey, we're all starving, we've all been, you know, underpaid, we're all getting treated like less than nothing or nothing, so we all need to unite and fight for the same cause. And if they do that, then they can, if they fight for their work rights and they fight for to be treated as human beings, then I bet you they can take the next step up and saying, hey, we need to work on other things. If we make the most important things, our living conditions good,
mm-hmm.
we can fix other things without solving, you know, sectarian violence or hate crimes. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good thing. For that to be, like, made that to be huge in Iraq.
In such circumstances, any form of integration is a good thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a communist integrator or socialist or whatever. It could be any form of integration. I would say, in such a chaotic society like current Iraqi society is, any form should be welcomed. You know, I wouldn't insist, if I were Iraqi living over there, I wouldn't insist on any political platform of a kind. What would matter to me would be to to rally the population around a common goal, which would be primarily to get rid of occupation. And then to start working on arranging internal affairs.
I agree with you to that on a certain point. And the reason I say that is because, yes, it's good for them to all to come together. But when the religious factor come in, they have their own hidden agendas behind. So they would come support your cause. But at the end, they want to be split in half. So you would follow their sect. You would follow their own ideas of things. So, yes, the Kurds in the north worked that great. But in the south of Iraq, you always have struggle. Like, when the religious factor come to support your cause, like any cause, they have their own agendas there. So they would support you to a certain point, but in return, you have to promise them certain things. So, and that is why I don't want the religious sector to take, because so far they only destroyed the country. And so far they also been the puppet government. You know, for anybody, the highest bidder. So, I would agree with you, people uniting is a good thing, but I would hope they would unite with knowledge and education instead of religious beliefs. And the reason why is because when a religious leader come to this, when people unite, he wants to be the leader right away, even though he does not know what it's for or, you know, what's that cause. Since he's a religious leader and he got 100 men behind him with weapons, officially he declares himself the leader right on the spot. So that is why some parts of the world I would agree, but in Iraq right now with the Iraqi government and the religious fanatic, when I said in the southwest and, you know, that part of the country, they want control. And so far they destroyed, I mean, they put people 100 years behind because of their political views, which they don't have none, but it's all about power to them. Money, power. And so I would hope I would love to see your view of it work in Iraq, but as long as you have the religious leaders, it would destroy it.
This was just a little digression I took a liberty to make simply because there was a similar experience back in Yugoslavia, in country I came from, particularly in Bosnia. Also, disintegration of society without an aggression from outside, like the way it happened in Iraq, but still with the same result. You know, you also have a stratification of society, sectarian exclusiveness, fight for power, local warlords also for 4 or 5 years. And that's what allowed me to take that liberty to comment on affairs in current affairs in Iraq.
True.
From this perspective now, after what I've been through back in Bosnia, I believe the crucial thing would be to fight the primary cause of the whole turmoil in Iraq and its occupation.
Of Iraq, I totally agree with you. And I am familiar with the Bosnia and the Serb War, you know, that happened. And yes, I totally agree with you and like about that war. But the thing is, yes, Iraq all need to unite for the occupation to leave Iraq. That's the number one cause, you know. And number two is them exploiting our oil and telling us they would sell, give us medicine and give us food, which we can grow our own, but they destroyed it during the war, you know, our crops and our fields. So yes, they need, I mean, I'm with you when you say they need to all unite to get the occupation out. But at the same time, is if they do get the occupation out, then the religious factor would take control. And when that happened, then there is no reason for Mayday, like they will destroy anybody that would oppose them. So I'm hoping that Mayday would become powerful enough in Iraq. So when they do,
as an integrating factor.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and they would get the occupation out. We would have the, I would like to say, the Mayday coalition or the people who organize it would take some sort of control of the power in Iraq.
Yeah.
Because as long as you have the religious factor in Iraq, and the only reason is I'm saying the religious factor is because right now Iraq would probably have about 5 militias, like 5 main militias in Iraq, and they have done nothing but destroy the country, and they are, most of them are on the U.S. payroll. Some of them are on the U.S. payroll, like Muqtada al-Sadr. He gets a monthly salary from the U.S. troops that he opposes, the U.S. military opposes, but he's getting paid in the millions to join, you know, to sit back and enjoy the money. And the day they don't pay him, he would rally up his, you know, religious fundamentalist or religious, you know, his military, and he would attack. So you see, we don't want people like him to run the country. Yeah. We don't.
Yeah. So okay, I apologize.
Oh no, thank.
I apologize once again for this digression.
No, Vladimir. No, I apologize. I'm not taking the wrong way, but my point of view of it is, like, we both seen war, and I don't want it, you know, and I know you don't want it to be in your country also.
Yeah,
but that's why I don't want the religious factor to take power.
I'm just going
to
take the mic here. We are at the halfway point of the show already. Starting to pick up a little bit of steam. We're talking about May Day here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's sort of an interesting conversation here. We're sort of comparing notes between Iraq and Yugoslavia. And I know a number of other commentators have picked up on this, too. They've sort of referred to the disintegration of Iraqi society as a Balkanization of Iraqi society, being a reference to the Balkan region where the former Yugoslavia lies.
I'll take it for offense. I would put it, it's Iraqization of Balkans.
But I want to put it to you this way, Vladimir. I mean, you lived in the former Yugoslavia at a time when it was probably about as unified and peaceful as it's been in a couple of centuries. I mean, it's traditionally been a lot of violence between the different ethnic groups there, going back to the early 20th century, isn't that right? I mean, prior to the unification of the modern Yugoslavia. But I mean, just I would just ask you, just trying to pull things back. We kind of digressed away from the basic, the original theme of May Day here. We're trying to bring it back to that a little bit. I mean, Wassam has sort of talked about May Day as maybe sort of a unifying event and factor for Iraq. I mean, was May Day a unifying factor in Yugoslavia?
No way.
No.
For May Day to be a unifying factor in late 19th century or early 20th century back in former Yugoslavia.
But during your lifetime, I mean, we can go back.
Yes, during my lifetime. But again, you can't say it was a spontaneous process. First of all, the level of industrialization of former Yugoslavia before World War One was very low compared to the rest of Europe, actually to the mainland of Europe, Western countries. Large part of former Yugoslavia was for more than 400 years occupied by Ottoman Empire, which was, as we know, not very advanced technologically. Another part was occupied by Austro-Hungarian Empire, which, as empires tend to do, exploited natural resources and labor when needed in a very small extent.
Kind of like our empire in the Iraqi oil fields right now?
I wouldn't go so far. This was 19th century. No,
there's a similar theme of empires exploiting resources, though, yes?
Yeah, yes. But also Hungarian empire did invest into infrastructure and industry in occupied areas, regions of them.
Well, that makes them a little more commendable than what we're doing to Iraq then, doesn't it?
Yes.
Slightly.
Yes.
Somewhat.
But then came World War One. Those two empires dissolved, Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires. And Yugoslavia was formed by a Versailles Treaty in 1918. In my opinion, as a reward to Serbia, which was allied with Britain and France, and Serbian dynasty ruled then Yugoslavia after 1918, and then began industrialization process the way it happened beforehand in Western Europe, and the working class finally started showing up on the political scene in former Yugoslavia. And yes, there was a very strong communist party between the two world wars. It was, believe it or not, the third strongest party in then Yugoslavia. May Day, of course, was very relevant. Education of the population also was one of the primary goals of the communist party. But unfortunately, then came World War II, and as the final result of division of spheres of interest between East and West, Yugoslavia was formed, was allowed to exist in its former borders, but this time without royal family leading the country. It was led by communists, since communists were all allied with Soviets, Britons, and France against Hitler and Mussolini. Okay, what is not a good comparison between May Day in Western Europe and May Day in Yugoslavia, and on the third side, May Day in Eastern Bloc, in the former Soviet Union and satellites, was that Yugoslavia really did develop after the break with Stalin in 1948. Yugoslavia did develop an autonomous form of socialism, and built a socialist society. That's why Erich Fromm said the two only socialist democracies in the world were Sweden and Yugoslavia. Why May Day had a different meaning in Western Europe compared to meaning of May Day in Yugoslavia and May Day in Eastern Bloc, three crucial things. In Western Europe, May Day was and still is an expression of liberation of working class in capitalist societies. In Eastern Bloc, May Day was just a formal holiday which was officially imposed on the society. And I've seen, when I was in Soviet Union in 1989, I've seen that May Day meant actually nothing to Soviet labor. But in Yugoslavia, in then Yugoslavia, in those days, May Day was really cherished. It was under the auspices of the state. But even so, there was not this repulsive connotation the way it existed in Soviet Union.
You're sort of saying that the Soviet Union kind of abused the legacy of May Day to legitimize its own government, the way it abused it the intellectual heritage of Karl Marx and so on.
Yes, it was actually a smokescreen, one of mirrors and smokes used in Soviet Union. Laborers knew perfectly well it was just a smokescreen. There was a saying in former Soviet Union, people would say, like, in capitalist society, there is exploitation of man by man.
Mm-hmm.
While in Soviet Union, it's the other way around. So it's a good illustration of a position of a Soviet laborer. He was fully aware of his role. He knew there's nothing of communists so loudly trumpeted all over the world. You can't trick anyone. Mm-hmm. You can't fool anyone into forcefully believing something imposed on them. It was the same way in Soviet Union. They were, unfortunately, Soviet labor was deeply disillusioned, deeply unhappy, you know, because they lost, they strongly believed in that better society, you know, and they were let down by leading structures long before World War II, from the very beginning, actually, by Lenin and Trotsky themselves. They imposed that dictatorship of proletariat or state capitalism and so on and so on. We all know that part of the history.
I'm going to go back a little bit more towards the labor and unions in the United States. I like kind of what Wissam was talking about, religious leaders getting involved in the movement and kind of trying to take their own power share. And it's interesting, I think, the dynamics of power over time. Whereas originally, they were trying to suppress unions, trying to stop people from organizing altogether. But now we have unions that, instead of having a sort of worker-based interest in international, just workers in general, they tend often to be workers in the United States, sort of have a nationalist unity, or any of the sort of divisive causes that you can have. And whereas Wissam was talking about religious divisions, you've had, especially in the past, leading up to the civil rights, other divisions in labor. There's gender divisions in labor, and there's racial and national divisions in labor. And kind of the different power dynamics that have tried to manipulate labor. And since they couldn't suppress the unionization and the strong labor movement to organize, it seems to me that they've worked more recently up to the common date to rather co-opt these organizations, to take them over. What do people think about that trend? Do you see that trend?
You're talking about Iraq currently.
I'm talking about the trend that I believe I've seen in the United States, how that compares internationally, and whether everyone here identifies that trend.
I can talk only as an outsider. What I've noticed here in the United States. Okay, yes, there is a pretty much reactionary role religions play in the United States when it comes to to fighting for welfare of working class in the United States. My impression is that most of religions religious organizations in the United States actually ruthlessly exploit the labor in the United States. But I have on the other side to remind you of extremely progressive role Catholic, actually not Catholic Church, but liberation theology played in South America, you know, for the benefit of labor. Many a priest got killed in Colombia and elsewhere in South America during that fight for the betterment of position of impoverished population of South America. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not religious. I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist. My first urge would be to be against interference of religious groups in the affair of class wars. Let's name them class war, as George Bush put it himself. Yes,
Warren Buffett as well.
Yeah, it would be my first urge, but I have to be fair and balanced. No, without any cynicism, we have to be fair. Yes, there are also religious movements which were a vanguard in the fight for laborers.
I don't believe he was really even necessarily talking about religion per se. Somewhat the divisions that have been exploited. I mean, the United States is probably the most diverse society on the face of the planet, maybe in all of history. And as far as, I mean, divide and conquer being the name of the game for power for since time immemorial, there's been fertile opportunities to keep the masses in this country at each other's throats. You play white against black, you play, you know, native born against immigrants, men against women, so on and so forth, all the way.
Really, this is much an issue of collective social effort versus competitive effort of pitting people against each other. Because you see that sort of in the unionist sort of nationalism, or the environmentalists versus the worker, industry pitting worker against worker, person against person. And in what Sam was talking about was, I think, in opposition to what you're talking about, the liberation theology, because that liberation theology can be cooperative. It can work with people because it puts the interest of people ahead of the interest of religious leadership.
Yeah, that was my point.
Kind of what Wassam was saying is that these leaders in Iraq and in the Middle Eastern area, their first goal is to take power, to seize power.
Well,
I believe that's what saying.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. And the thing about religion is it's the best thing at dividing people. You know, it's one of the best things that divide people. And when Vladimir was saying about South America, how, you know, priests were getting killed for people. Well, also, like, from my point of view, also religion produces, like, modern-day slavery, you know, like how people work and exploit themselves and, like, work and never question. Then go to a church, to a mosque, to a temple, then put in the money they earn in there, you know, then they go back and work. You see, so religion, it's also part of man's downfall to a certain point. I know some of you guys might not agree with me, but I believe it's man's downfall, you know, to a certain point.
Well, I think we're all atheists at the table, so I don't know that we'll have an argument about that.
You know, I was young long ago, and I was pretty much intolerant when it came to talking about religions. But as I grew older, I learned, at a small extent at least, I hope, at a less small extent, I learned tolerance when it comes to religions. Religions are here. They exist. We produced them. Religions are our babies.
Yeah, man-made.
And it's up to us what we are going to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But so it's how to put it? It's a closed loop. You know, yes, religions do have huge impact on societies, but on the other side, we ourselves also have impact on religions. As an illustration, for instance, talking about liberation theology, Archbishop Camara of Recife in Brazil, he said a nice thing. He said, when I give bread to the poor, they call me a saint. But when I ask, why are there poor in this world, they call me a communist. You know, that's, I would say, that sums up the role of religions in our lives.
Well, we got about 10 minutes left in this May Day show, and we've been bouncing all over the place. It's really been a lot of fun. I do want to kind of bring it back to the central topic a little bit. We did talk earlier, I mean, sort of about, you know, the urgent need for a labor movement in Iraq and the importance of a May Day movement in Iraq because, as Wassam said, workers have no rights. But really, we also have a need for a stronger labor movement and a revival of the May Day holiday here in the United States.
Yeah, I think the main point actually is that May Day started as an internationalist working class movement. So to say that you need a stronger May Day movement in any particular country is kind of defeats the purpose of May Day. May Day should be working class wide. Eleanor Marx said, at least at the first commemoration of the Haymarket Massacre in 1890, that the May Day event is not about political parties. We have come here in the cause of labor and its own defense, demand its own rights. She didn't say American labor, German labor, Iraqi labor. Mm. She meant the working class, the international working class, which is how May Day really got planned. It was an organization of labor unions across Europe. In the United States, it spread to India, China, the Soviet Union, everywhere. And it was, at least in its foundation, it was not about a political party,
affiliation,
a religious group, like liberation theology. They weren't giving bread to the poor to, you know, better the image of the Catholic Church. They were giving bread to the poor to help the poor because it was in the interests of the poor. So I think that's one of the things we've lost is this internationalist perspective.
But really,
this working class.
What I'm saying, though, is that this country really needs to play catch up. I mean the rates of union membership in this country have just practically fallen through the floor. I mean, what do they mean? They're probably practically to 100-year lows by now.
Oh yeah, I think it's back to what it was before the 1930s. So there was a huge organizing drive after the financial crisis, the Great Depression. But right now, I mean, there's not that. It's,
I mean, what is the statistic for labor, for union membership at this point? Last I saw, it was at single digits in the private sector. I mean, it's less than 10% of the American people belong to a labor union.
But it was in 35, 36 after World War II, and it dropped to 12% last I saw on paper. It might easily be under that.
I mean that number is somewhat inflated because a lot of the people who work for the government do have the right to a union. I mean, when you separate it into public sector employment and private sector employment, private sector union membership is in the single digits.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of the things I hear, though, is that people don't want to be involved in unions because they're no longer grassroots organizations. Kind of what Charles was saying, they're no longer organizations of the people, they're rather organizations of themselves, of their own interests. What do you have to say about that? That's one point,
but I think that's kind of blaming the lack of union power on the unions themselves, which, I mean, if you look at polls and surveys done in the United States, like 70-80% of American workers are in favor of this idea of the right to organize and the ability to organize. The problem is there's been a continuous war against the ability to even start a union, so against the ability to have a grassroots labor movement. And it's been that way basically since the 60s and 70s, particularly in the 70s when we had a financial crisis, the UAW, the auto workers, their unions had used to, I think it was like 450,000 rank and file members. Today it's like 80,000 at that. And we're continuing to close plants, and we're opening ones in the south because their workers aren't unionized.
Toyota.
And they have absolutely no real right to organize. That's one of the things I like about a quote from Karl Marx in his chapter in Capital called The Working Day, which has some really insightful things that you can apply to how May Day developed as an institution. But he said, between equal rights, force decides. So yeah, we all have the right to organize and assemble, but capital has a much stronger right to do so. And until we get together and fight back against that, you're not going to get a working class movement in the United States.
So what are we going to do about it? How are we going to turn around these sagging unionization numbers? How do we turn it around?
Well, we need to take advantage, I think, right now of the progressive spirit and momentum that kind of built up during the Obama campaign for president and the Democratic successes in Congress in the last election, realizing that those electoral victories really weren't victories for working people necessarily, but it opens up a window of opportunity for other progressive movements to get their agenda on the table. For example, May Day, they were calling for an 8-hour workday. That was their main goal everywhere,
right,
internationally. But that wasn't their only goal. Their goal was eventually, you know, for the communists and anarchists, a classless society. For others, just a more equitable workplace. Now we have legislation, and they said, we want the legal enactment of an 8-hour workday. We need this reform in order to create revolution. Right now we have something on the Senate floor called the Employee Free Choice Act, which, if this is passed, legally enacted, you can create a window of opportunity to actually reinvigorate the labor movement in the United States, I think. So I think that's one of the things people interested
in. Can you tell us in 30 seconds what the Employee Free Choice Act would do?
The Employee Free Choice Act would essentially make it easier for workers to organize unions, because it takes the mechanism for forming a union out of the hands of the employer and puts it back into the hands of the employees through majority card sign-up or secret ballot elections. Two, it enforces the labor laws by raising the penalties for employers who intimidate union organizers to $20,000 per violation. Three, it makes sure that you will get a contract with your union, between your union and your employer, within like 90 days of the formation of your union. So
okay,
those three things probably.
So yeah, the cynical voice in the back of my head is saying, everyone in Washington is bought and paid for by capital. What's so great about this piece of legislation if it even has a snowball's chance in hell of passing? I mean, why would the agents of capital in Washington support this legislation? Why would they vote to enact it?
Well, it's similar for reasons why the bourgeoisie in England passed things like the 10-hour workday or repealed the corn laws. They did it in their interest. A lot of people realize, hey, we're working our workers to death. We're losing our labor force. It is in our interest to reduce the working day. So, for one, they don't uprise and start a rebellion. Number two, so we can create more profits. I think, also, it's kind of false to assume that everyone is bought by capital. Yes, capital plays a large role, but the political base of these parties, who votes for them? It's not big capital. It's working-class Americans who elect these individuals. So if they lose the faith and loyalty of the working class, they have a problem on their hands.
But going back to what you quoted from Marx there a couple minutes ago, force prevails.
Yeah.
We might get to vote for the Democratic Party every 2 years, every 4 years, but who's paying for the lobbyists in Washington? Who's talking in these senators' ears every morning?
Yeah, that's why it's it's Walmart, it's ExxonMobil, it's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But we have political power ourselves, and that's what Marx argues, that we have labor. It is our labor is where the working class has their power. So It's kind of a circular thing, you know. We need unions, we need to be organized in order to be able to withhold our labor and make it less profitable in order to gain a balance of power with, I don't know, the owners of capital at this country. But at the same time, right now, since we don't have that, it's going to be a real struggle, I think.
I would like to add what Chuck is... I would like to add with Chuck, he's right about we have the force. Because if you have a company that you run and none of your workers show up the next day, how are you going to put out your product? So you have to listen to the people.
Well, we're in the first place, we're bordering on the edge of another show topic here. And we're also running out of time on this show. I want to just end it off on one question here. How can we revive May Day in the United States? Would anyone like to take a stab at that?
I would personally say that what we need is not a revival of May Day, but a revival of the ideas contained within the institution of May Day. So internationalism, working class expression of their aspirations for freedom and equality, movements not based on political parties or religious groups or what have you, but movements based off the broader goal. For example, in Iraq, not a movement based off, we want power, we want this, we want that, but we want to get the U.S. out of our country so we can be self-determinant. In the United States, we don't want a Democratic senator, we don't want this labor union representing us. What we want is a living wage. So we need to broaden our perspectives a little bit and realize that we share interests with not only the working people of this country, but across the world.
May I add?
Final comment, go ahead.
Huh, again.
Well, we have final comments for everyone at the table. This is your final comment.
Yeah. I agree. Charles made an excellent point. But I would add that May Day is needed as a symbol. All movements, organizations need their small rituals, you know, because that's what builds awareness of belonging to that very same movement, you know. No wonder churches have abundance of their rituals. Let's make a May Day one of our rituals again.
I'm going to agree with you entirely on that. I definitely agree with the values that Charles is talking about, but I think there is significant symbolic value in restoring a recognition of Labor Day to May Day, May 1st to May Day, when the rest of the world celebrates it too.
Yes.
I would like to add to your question, how can we revive May Day? Well, during this time right now, it's a huge recession. People are losing their jobs, their homes, no rights. And the big CEOs having basically the bourgeoisie still in power, controlling everything. So I think it's a good time for right now for people to unite, to bring back the ideas of May Day, like Charles stated earlier, and to bring it back and for the workers to fight and to get their jobs back. Or
I think we do need to revive May Day and make it not just another Halloween trick-or-treating out there for candy. We actually need workers to organize. Like you were saying, it's an international event, and workers in the United States need to be a part of that. It needs to be a grassroots community effort, not a celebration of parties or any other sort of organization, just uniting the workers in solidarity.
And that'll be it. Thank you very much, guys. This has really been fun. May Day.
Yes.
We won.
For Wassam, Andrew, Charles, Vladimir, I'm Jackson. We'll see you next time.